On the 11th of May, 1831, two French travelers, Alexis de Tocqueville and Gustave de Beaumont, stepped off the 500-ton brig Le Havre in New York and proceeded to conduct one of the most interesting journeys ever pursued across the face of America. They were not explorers in the usual sense of the term. They were in pursuit of something more elusive. And that was the set of fundamental principles which allowed the American Republic to survive. Republicanism might have been the darling political theory of the Enlightenment. But after the American founding, republicanism had enjoyed a rocky and disappointing career as an idea of government. The republic created by the French revolutionaries in 1789, in imitation of the American one, declined swiftly into a reign of terror, then into disarray, and then into the hands of a dictator, Napoleon Bonaparte. And when Bonaparte's empire itself collapsed under the blows of Europe's remaining kings and emperors, the victorious Allies insisted on turning the clock of French politics back to 1789 and placing a king, Louis XVIII, on a restored French throne in 1815. Meanwhile, the political ideals of the Enlightenment were challenged and succeeded by a violent gust of reaction known as the Romantic Revolt. Not reason, insisted the Romantics, but passion was what formed nations. Not logic, but race and blood gave identity to peoples. So as Europeans planted themselves all over the world, they did so at the behest of aristocratic governments, gathering new strength from the practical failures of republicanism and the stormy winds of romanticism. Only the United States remained as the one large-scale and successful example of a republic in the world. Yet the republican dream lived on. And Alexis de Tocqueville was one example of its persistence. Tocqueville's forebears were local aristocrats from Normandy. His great-grandfather, Guillaume Chrétien de Malesherbes, had been legal counsel to the doomed King Louis XVI at his trial by the revolutionaries, and lost his head along with the king. His father, Hervé Louis Clairel, Comte de Tocqueville, only missed the guillotine because Robespierre went there first, and thus ended the Reign of Terror. But Hervé de Tocqueville's loyalty to the monarchy met only meager rewards from the restored King of France in 1815, and his son, Alexis, grew up with few starry-eyed illusions about aristocrats. For one thing, the son married an Englishwoman, Mary Motley, and the language spoken in their home was English. Moreover, as a student at the Sorbonne in 1829-30, he came under the spell of the French liberal republican, François Guizot, from whom he learned that history was a record of the movement of progress, and that progress had equality as its goal. Tocqueville caught a fleeting glimpse of that future for France in 1830 when the king was overthrown, but it was only a fleeting glimpse. A new monarch was installed, and Tocqueville reluctantly took an oath of allegiance to him. No one seemed to believe anymore that a republic was a viable alternative. And so Tocqueville began casting around for an example that would convince people otherwise. And that, in 1831, was what brought him to the United States. Officially, he was making the journey with his longtime friend Beaumont, as a commission from the Minister of the Interior to study the American prison system. Personally, Tocqueville had a strong desire to visit North America and see what a great republic is. Tocqueville and Beaumont would actually stay in America for only slightly more than 9 months. They dutifully visited prisons and homes for juvenile delinquents. But their real task was to spend as much time there as we can researching statistics on the conditions of the population, on public institutions, and on all the political questions that concern us. They journeyed upriver to Albany, west to Niagara Falls, across the Great Lakes to Detroit, Quebec, and Montreal, then doubling back to Boston in September, and Philadelphia, and then Baltimore. By January 1832, they had visited Cincinnati, Nashville, Memphis, and New Orleans as visitors, and made one last turn through Washington and New York before departing for France in February. Along the way, they had met almost as many interesting personalities as they had cities. John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams and the single-term sixth president. Andrew Jackson, now the seventh president. Albert Gallatin, John Marshall, Henry Clay, even the last surviving signer of the Declaration of Independence, the 94-year-old Charles Carroll of Carrollton. Of course, by 1832, the ranks of the founders had grown exceedingly thin. Of the 39 who walked up to Washington's table in the Pennsylvania State House on September 17, 1787, to sign the Constitution, four of them died in 1790, including the tottering Benjamin Franklin, but also including David Brearley, who had chaired the Committee on Postponed Parts. Flinty old Roger Sherman of Connecticut followed in 1793, having earned the singular distinction of being a part of the Continental Congresses, the Confederation Congress, the Constitutional Convention, and the first U.S. Congress. The scholarly, nearsighted James Wilson became the first professor of law at the College of Philadelphia in 1790, and was appointed by George Washington as one of the six justices of the original Supreme Court, even though he only heard nine cases before his death in 1798. Washington himself followed in 1799 after developing a cold, which in turn flared into pneumonia. In his will, he freed all of the 160 slaves which belonged to him by title. Martha Dandridge Custis Washington died less than 3 years later. She made no similar provision for the 80 slaves she retained at the time of her death. Her granddaughter, Mary Anna Custis, would marry a professional soldier who led the last great resistance to emancipation. His name was Robert E. Lee. Patrick Henry predeceased his old friend Washington by 7 months. Although, unlike the religiously chilly Washington, Henry died as the Great Awakening had taught him to live, in the full confidence that through the merits of a bleeding Savior that his sins would be pardoned. But neither did Henry free his slaves. John Rutledge, who had so fiercely resisted any attempt by the Constitution to speak about slavery at all, died in 1800, as did Thomas Mifflin, who had resisted so fiercely any attempt to manage his life by good sense. Alexander Hamilton's duel with Aaron Burr cost Hamilton his life in 1804, but that may have been, on the whole, less painful than the death of Robert Morris, bankrupt and in poverty, in 1806, or of Benjamin Banneker, who died of alcoholism and just as penniless in a log cabin the same year as Morris. William Marbury, who sued to get the judge's commission Thomas Jefferson refused to deliver, never did get the commission. His home on M Street in Georgetown is presently used as the Ukrainian embassy. James McHenry died in 1816, with the satisfaction of seeing the fort named in his honor in Baltimore Harbor form the rock on which the British invasion of the Chesapeake foundered and about which the Star-Spangled Banner was written. Gouverneur Morris died the same year, a dandy to the end, having served as Minister Plenipotentiary to France, a United States Senator, and a chairman of the Erie Canal Commission. He never withdrew a jot of his opposition to slavery. But he also predicted that the proudest empire in Europe is but a bubble compared to what America will be, must be, in the course of two centuries, perhaps of one. Timothy Dwight followed Morris, much more colorlessly, in 1817, but with an equal confidence that America would unfold how pious realms to glory rise and impious nations find avenging skies. Notwithstanding whatever ill effects whiskey and the Whiskey Rebellion might have had on him, William Findlay lived on until 1821, cantankerous and venerated, serving in Congress from his western Pennsylvania home from 1790 till 1797, and again from 1804 till 1817, and eventually becoming the senior serving member of the House of Representatives, and known as the Father of the House. The man who arrived at the Constitutional Convention with his own plan for a federal government in hand, Charles Pinckney, died in 1824, followed a year later by his kinsman and head of the delegation which had faced down the XYZ bribery demands, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. Daniel Shays died that same year on his farm in Sparta, New York, where he had fled after his rebellion. Luther Martin, falling into alcoholism and poverty, was taken in by his one-time client, Aaron Burr, and died under Burr's roof in New York City in 1826. John Lansing, who with Robert Yates had walked out of the Constitutional Convention in protest, went on to serve as Chief Justice of the New York State Supreme Court and disappeared in 1829. When he left his home to mail some letters and never returned, no trace of him was ever found. After Thomas Jefferson left the presidency, his presidential antagonist, John Adams, put out peace feelers. And from those feelers sprang a golden correspondence between two reconciled old friends, which has no parallel in American literature. Jefferson lived on, hale and hearty, until his final decline in 1826, dying 40 minutes after noon on July 4th at Monticello, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. John Adams died later that same day, but not before making one final mistake about Jefferson. Adams's last words were, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." Rufus King, who opposed slavery so bitterly in the Constitutional Convention, served as George Washington's representative to Great Britain. He was one of the rare Federalists whom Jefferson did not recall from office after Jefferson's election in 1800. But King resigned the post anyway, and in 1804 he was the Federalist candidate for vice president. He was elected to the United States Senate for New York in 1813 and sat there until 1825, when he served a second tour as American minister to Great Britain. He was a member of the Senate in 1820 when the proposed admission of Missouri as a slave state triggered the first great national confrontation on slavery and blew to pieces forever the confidence the Constitutional Convention had had that slavery was on a steady downward path to extinction. King died in 1827, 2 years before John Jay, who was, if anything, an even more aggressive opponent of slavery, occasionally buying slaves outright so that he could set them free. Like Patrick Henry and Roger Sherman, Jay could not believe that the Republic could survive without embracing the moral precepts of the Christian religion. One unhappy reminder of the passions of the 1790s died in 1834 in upstate New York. Edmund Charles Genet, the one-time and notorious Citizen Genet. Recalled to Paris after his party, the Girondins, were replaced by the Jacobins, Genet realized that a return to France would lead him straight to the guillotine. He instead quietly disappeared to upstate New York, where he eventually married a daughter of the uproarious New York governor, George Clinton, and lived a quiet life as a gentleman farmer. John Marshall died in 1835 in Philadelphia, still in harness as Chief Justice. Ever since, it has been a matter of legend that the Liberty Bell obtained its famous crack while tolling for Marshall's funeral. Although in all likelihood, the bell got its crack while ringing for Washington's birthday in 1846. The man Marshall had set at liberty, Aaron Burr, died a year later in New York City. That left, at the end, only one man standing. And that was the man Tocqueville expressed regret at not having interviewed, James Madison, the last survivor of the Constitutional Convention, and after Charles Carroll's death, the last real survivor of the founders. Now, at age 80, he had come out of retirement only once in 1829 to serve as a delegate from Orange County to the new Virginia Constitutional Convention. And in the only speech he delivered at the convention, he might have been summarizing in advance for Tocqueville what he would have told the Frenchman face to face. That the essence of government is power, and power, lodged as it must be in human hands, will ever be liable to abuse. Madison had never flagged in his belief that the great danger to liberty was power. Power was an intoxicant, seizing one object by force and unable to resist seizing the next and the next. But power was also a necessity, without which liberty could not survive, if only for the purpose of self-protection. In monarchies and tyrannies, we always know in what direction power acts, from the top down. The novelty in republics is that it can just as easily operate from the bottom up. And all of the labors he had devoted to the Constitutional Convention had been aimed at preventing bottom-up power from creating lawless local despotisms. Just as all of the labor he had expended afterward was concerned with containing top-down abuses. Madison also took the opportunity to ask for a correction to the one great oversight of the summer of 1787, and that concerns slavery. One of the principal reasons for convening a state constitutional convention in 1829 was to look hard at the possibility, somehow, of emancipating Virginia's slaves. And without actually using the word emancipation, he made a surprising and eloquent plea to the convention on behalf of the slaves. It is due to justice, due to humanity, due to truth, to the sympathies of our nature, in fine, to our character as a people, both abroad and at home, that they should be considered as much as possible in the light of human beings and not as mere property. If they had the complexion of the serfs in the north of Europe, or the villeins formerly in England, in other terms, if they were of our own complexion, much of the difficulty would be removed. But the mere circumstance of complexion cannot deprive them of the character of men. Emancipation was the one remaining stone that would complete the wonderful edifice of liberty, Madison asserted. Other nations are surprised at nothing so much as our having been able to form constitutions in the manner which has been exemplified in this country. Even the union of so many states is, in the eyes of the world, a miracle. If Americans had been able to do so much so quickly, then Madison was confident that, even without a miracle, we shall be able to arrange all difficulties. I have now more than a hope, a consoling confidence that we shall at last find that our labors have not been in vain. In his travels through the United States, the one word which Alexis de Tocqueville did not hear was virtue. In the United States, it is almost never said that virtue is beautiful, Tocqueville wrote. Virtue instead was useful, but not more than useful, because the glue which really held together the American Republic was, as Hamilton had anticipated, self-interest. The doctrine of self-interest, well understood, has been universally accepted, Tocqueville wrote. One finds it at the foundation of all actions. It pierces into all discussions. Americans had not formed communities or a constitution in search of righteousness, but in search of self-interest and profits. Karl Marx, in the next decade, would write about society and economics as a war between classes, in which profits were the chief cause of personal alienation and conflict the ceaseless order of the day. But the only conflict Tocqueville saw in America was between profit-seeking individuals who were, ironically, entirely in agreement with each other about the pursuit of self-interest. It is encountered, Tocqueville wrote, not less in the mouth of the poor man than that of the rich. And even more ironically, it was the pursuit of wealth, the pursuit of self-interest, which really did produce virtue, rather than, as Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson had thought, the other way around. The doctrine of self-interest, well understood, does not produce great devotion, Tocqueville acknowledged. By itself, it cannot make a man virtuous, but it forms a multitude of citizens who are regulated, temperate, moderate, far-sighted, masters of themselves. The great exception to this self-mastery was, of course, American slavery. But even among the enslaved, as Frederick Douglass would later say, what the slave wanted most in freedom was the free pursuit of self-interest, the undisturbed possession of the natural fruits of his own exertions. After that, Douglass said, there is really little left for society and government to do. But what would happen if self-interest became the only guide to politics? What would prevent self-interested characters like Aaron Burr from aspiring to the role of Caesar? What would prevent self-interest from appealing to the lowest forms of depravity? The answers, as Tocqueville noted, lay in two uniquely American institutions: newspapers and voluntary associations. Newspapers, Tocqueville said, make political life circulate in all sections of this vast territory and open public affairs to the inspection of every reader. Newspapers head off potential Caesars by exposing the secret springs of politics and forcing public men to come in turn to appear before the court of opinion. Voluntary associations are what took Tocqueville's notice as organizations of citizens, collected at their own prompting for the goals of public security, of commerce and industry, or morality and religion. These voluntary organizations performed in America much of the social work that governments in Europe took unto themselves, and so they formed a layer of resistance to political overreach by American governments. Most of these voluntary associations were religious, churches, for instance. But Americans have also a thousand other kinds of these associations. Americans, said Tocqueville, use associations to give fetes, to found seminaries, to build inns, to raise churches, to distribute books, to send missionaries to the Antipodes. In fact, where at the head of any new undertaking in France or England you see the government or a great lord, in America, you will find an association. Self-interest posed one other threat to democracy, although it was a much more subtle one. In a society where self-interest trumps virtue, the demand for equality would eventually supplant the passion for liberty. Tocqueville's Americans believed that liberty and equality were perfectly compatible because all that equality meant to Americans was the equal standing of citizens before the laws. But Tocqueville had learned through his family's experience of the French Revolution that equality might have more ominous overtones of envy, resentment, and leveling. When Tocqueville published his observations in two parts in 1835 and 1840 as Democracy in America, he did not believe that the perils that equality brings to human independence were insurmountable. But he was worried that the pursuit of equality might lead in two fatal directions. First, toward a demand for conformity, and usually conformity to the lowest cultural standard. Judgment, taste, and distinction in a democracy can actually become suspect. Instead, a cheapened and debased public opinion rules self-righteously. The human spirit, Tocqueville wrote, having broken all the shackles that classes or men formerly imposed on it, would be tightly chained to the general will of the greatest number. This power is not like the tyrannies of older times. It is a kind of reverse snobbery. It does not break wills, Tocqueville said, but it softens them, bends them, and directs them. It rarely forces one to act, but it constantly opposes itself to one's acting. It does not destroy. It prevents things from being born. It does not tyrannize. It hinders, compromises, enervates, extinguishes, dazes. Second possible outcome that he feared was a temptation to resort to power to enforce this equality. Power in which every nation becomes reduced to nothing more than a herd of timid and industrious animals, of which, Tocqueville said, the government is the shepherd. As with every resort to power, it will come with the best of intentions and will be administered with seeming gentleness by a diligent and even benevolent bureaucracy, so gentle that the people who were otherwise so vigilant against the demands of power would scarcely notice the evaporation of liberty. In our day, Tocqueville warned, there are many people who accommodate themselves very easily to this kind of compromise between administrative despotism and the sovereignty of the people, and who think they have guaranteed the freedom of individuals well enough when they deliver it to the national power. For the moment, in America, the newspapers and the voluntary associations, especially the religious ones, had staved off this fate. They were a buffer between government and the people, between power and liberty. Remove that buffer, and either government would swell up to fill the vacuum, or liberty would run amok and bring down despotism. Despotism either in the form of cheap cultural conformity or outright political leveling on American heads. When the day arrived that the newspapers and the associations ceased to function, then this new form of despotism, a soft despotism, would have arrived, in which people thoughtlessly chained their own shackles to themselves, equal in the worst sense of the word, but no longer at liberty. In an odd way, Tocqueville and Madison complement each other. Both of them understood that all government is an awkward and constantly adjusting dance between liberty and power. Both understood that the threat of power can come from below as well as from above. Both of them hoped that by divvying up power and distributing it broadly, whether between the branches of government, or in the form of voluntary associations, or between the states and the national government, by dividing it and separating it, power could be made to serve liberty's purposes. But they knew that liberty's life was always precarious. Emerging from the locked doors of the Constitutional Convention in September 1787, a voice called out to Benjamin Franklin, "What is it? Republic or monarchy?" Franklin stopped to reply, hopefully with a twinkle in his still mischievous eye, "A republic, if you can keep it." The question and its answer are still with us.